Sairam, dear listeners. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, welcoming you all to yet another episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth. Questions posed by you listeners form the basis on which we explore Swami's message. Thanks to the varied nature of the questions posed by you all, we are getting to get a glimpse of how Swami has spoken on almost every topic conceivable and has given solutions to every problem we could ever face. But taking Swami's words of advice in life situations is like using the navigation tool in a map on our smartphones. The app will first tell you which is the easiest and shortest route to the destination. But sometimes we miss a turn or take a wrong turn. That does not mean that all is lost and we cannot find our way to the destination, because the app will quickly reroute and show you what is the best option now, after you have lost your way. That way, how many ever times we take the wrong turns or we miss turns, it will keep guiding us according to the position we are in at that point in time. Same is the case with this journey of life and Swami's guidance. If any of us have gone astray in life, taken a wrong turning or missed an exit, let us not lose hope and give up. It does not mean that we can never make it to the destination. Swami will still guide us, but He will help us find a way from where we are. But it is best for us to follow the instructions scrupulously, for that way we reach the destination quickly and with least trouble. To be able to do that, we must have one of two things: either the intense craving to reach the destination, which is referred to as mumukshatvam, or intense love for Swami or ananya bhakti, that we cannot not follow Swami ever. Let's head to the program this week. As always, there is a very interesting question this week, which I'm sure is a question that bothers many other listeners too. There's a lot to explain, so I'm hoping I'll be able to do justice to that, given that we've started a bit late today. But before that, let me read for you a quote that I found very profound. A couple of weeks back, one of the listeners in their question made a reference to a book called Dying to Be Me. The quote I'm going to read out is by the author of that very book, Miss Anita Murjani. And here is the quote: "The more we try and understand enlightenment, the more it will elude us. And that's because enlightenment does not come from the mind. It comes from no mind. It comes from just being. You already are enlightened. You just have to realize it to allow it to into your experience." End of quote. One of the most profound statements that can be found in the Vedas is Yato Vacho Nivartante Aprapya Manasa Saha. It means the truth is where the faculties of speech and mind try to reach but return unsuccessful. We may endlessly argue about the nature of enlightenment, what happens after that, and so on. But the truth is, we have no clue whatsoever, because it is by nature beyond speech and thought. But the beauty is, as Swami says, we all have that complete awareness within each one of us. But the mind, which is filled with this idea of body consciousness, clouds it and makes it believe that what has been learnt through the body alone is the knowledge that belongs to it. So all spiritual exercises are not to enlighten the mind, but to sublimate it. And Swami says, first the mind or the antakarna has to be purified through good thoughts, good feelings, love and goodwill for all. Then the purified antakarna has to be sublimated. And when one becomes an amanaska, one not limited by the mind, one does not become enlightened, but enlightenment is no more hidden by the mind. Like how the embers shine when the ashes covering it are blown away, or a cloth returns to its natural whiteness after the stains have been removed. Swami says, a true nature of Sat, Chit and Ananda shines forth when the mind is completely sublimated. While it's easy to explain, but I'm sure what I've said does not do any justice to what really enlightenment is, or the process for that matter. And however much you feel you've understood it, it's not what it is, because it is Yato Vacho Nivartante Aprapya Manasasa. But each one of us are going through that process of purification and sublimation of the mind nevertheless. So before heading to the question of the week, permit me, dear listeners, to read that quote by Anita Murjani one more time. I quote, The more we try and understand enlightenment, the more it will elude us, and that's because enlightenment does not come from the mind. It comes from no mind. It comes from just being. You already are enlightened. You just have to realize it to allow it into your experience. Let's head to the question for this week. And the question was sent by a person who wishes to be anonymous, so I wouldn't be naming him. I have Brother Ganesh to read out the question for me. I have it in his voice. I'll play out the question. And then, of course, let's see what Swami has told us, and let's hopefully get a better understanding of this question.
Sai Ram, I had already sent a question about rebirth. This time, I have another important question, and please be kind enough to explain with Swami's grace. Everyone knows what fate is. Can this fate be changed by spiritual practices? Can the bad effects of the planets in the horoscope be changed by prayers to Swami instead of prayers to the respective planets? My only son, who is 27 years old, commenced his medical career in 2012. But now, in the final year, he has lost interest in completing the course owing to bad company of friends here. But he goes for bhajans and sings bhajans in our center. I and my wife are very worried about his future. We have been praying to Swami earnestly to change him and his personality. Horoscope indicates that he is undergoing a very bad period, which will be there for another 3 years. We don't know what to do. He does not listen to his parents at all. We are scared to advise him as he loses his temper very badly. He doesn't want to meet a counselor too. I don't know how you could advise, but I am very sure you may guide us as parents with correct advice. This is why I am perturbed about this fate. Can God's grace change the fate at any cost?
Though the last sentence of that question was precisely what the question is all about, can God's grace change fate at all? But nevertheless, there are three distinct questions or sub-questions in that entire question which was asked to us. One is, of course, is fate immutable or can it be changed by spiritual practices? Grace comes later, but through our spiritual practices, can we change our fate? And the second question I can pull out from there is, can the influence of planets be changed by prayers to Swami instead of prayers to the planets? I think that's an interesting question, isn't it? Well, that pertains to astrology. We'll come to that. And finally, the problem which is more specific, relating to a son who seems to be going astray. And more importantly, the piece of information they have is that his horoscope suggests that he's going through a bad patch. So how do you deal with that? But as you can see in the question itself, the three questions are interrelated. They're not completely standalone ones. So let's start with fate. Is fate immutable? Should we just suffer it and accept it as it is? We cannot do anything about it. You know, there's always this debate about, is everything predestined and is everything destiny? Is everything fate? Don't we have any choice at all? I think there are different debates in that. One is about destiny and free will, but this is about probably a little bit of accepting of what is fate and whether we can do something to change it, or whatever we are doing is ruled by fate. I would not go into that classic debate about free will and destiny. I think that will take us in a completely different direction. But it's more about fate as we, you know, probably go to an astrologer and he tells you that this is what is going to happen in your life. You know, somebody reads your palm and says that, you know, this is what is going to happen. Or, of course, there are many, many different things like that. You have Nadi astrology, you have tarot reading, and I don't know, in the other cultures there must be plenty like this. So when someone says that this is the fate for your life, what is the correlation between that fate and the actions that we do? Can the actions that we do in any way stop, change, or completely avoid any of this fate which we are meant to undergo in that particular life? So before we come to the part of astrology and the predictions part, let's talk about fate itself. Now, what is it that we refer to as fate? What is it that we refer to as destiny in one's lifetime? I think I've spoken about this on multiple occasions earlier too. It is nothing but, you know, from the entire bank of karma that we have, and that entire bank of karma is supposed to be called Sanchita Karma, right? It's over many, many lifetimes whatever we have collected. Because every action which is performed has a reaction. And Swami says that karma, you know, keeps adding up and you have this huge pile of Sanchita Karma. But every time a soul chooses to enter a human body, when it has the opportunity to do that, when it has the blessing to do that, so when the soul enters into the human frame, it brings along a certain part of that karma to work out in this particular lifetime. So from that Sanchita Karma, what it brings out to work out in this particular lifetime is called Prarabdha Karma, right? And this Prarabdha Karma pretty much is what we refer to as fate, what we refer to as destiny, what I'm going to undergo in this life, right? So what is important to understand is every action, good, bad, big, small, whatever it is, every action has a consequence, right? There are some small actions which we probably do very casually, and the consequences for those actions come literally immediately. You know, you could have, we do hundreds and hundreds of such actions throughout the day. For instance, I, you know, wake up every day and brush my teeth, and the consequence of that is oral hygiene. Or let's say I eat unhealthy food, the consequence of that is loss of good health. And these consequences seem to manifest pretty immediately and in a very conceivable time frame, right? So these are many, many small actions that we do, which will have immediate reactions. But some of the big choices that we make, especially those choices and those reactions behind which we put our emotions, like strong desires, hatred, anger, jealousy, even compassion, and a lot of sympathy and empathy, all of these things are emotions being put behind an action. We consciously choose, or we are not able to control our emotions, and these emotions are leading us to take some actions. Or even some of those actions which we do and which harms others or hurts others in some ways. Or when we do something really good, thinking that, you know, when we go and do charity and say that I'm doing charity now so that I will get the benefit later, or I'm doing this yajna now so that the benefits will come to me later. So you are doing it with the idea that you're putting a little bit of desire behind that action. So all of these, Swami says, are heavy actions, actions which have very deep karma. Sometimes it comes in the same lifetime. Sometimes it again adds to the pile of the Sanchita Karma, which is an ever-growing pile. If you don't turn to a spiritual life and don't do such actions which start relieving you from this action-reaction cycle, we will only keep endlessly adding to this Sanchita Karma, right? So when we do actions which are good, some actions, as I said, will have reactions in this very birth. When such actions happen, you know, we are literally modifying to an extent the fate which we are supposed to live through. But many times it's very difficult to understand what actions which we do is going to benefit us immediately in this birth, or it's going to come back to us sometime later. But nevertheless, every action has a reaction, and every action is modifying your fate now or the fate of the future. So that is something which have to be, you know, constantly kept in mind. So the point is that we have to remember the relationship between our actions, our choices, our karma, and our fate or destiny is through our actions constantly we are shaping our fate. And that's something we have to always keep in mind. Let me give you a very simple example at the risk of making this very, very trivial. I'm going to give a very simple example. Hopefully you'll be able to relate to that. Take the example of you sending out an email, right? You type an email and, you can think before you type. Then you frame whatever you want to type in an email. Then you type the email and then you send it. And, you know, the mail servers these days, even as you start typing the email, it starts saving it in what you call the draft, right? It makes a draft of whatever you're writing. So sometimes you've written about, let's say, 3 or 4 paragraphs, and then you want to change something in the first paragraph. As long as the email is in your draft, you can always go back to the draft and change, make edits, right? Let's say you have sent the email, and you know some email clients like Gmail give you that option. Even after you send the email, it'll give you a 3-second window by which you can cancel and still edit your email. But once you send your email, let's say the email is sent, there's nothing you can do. Now you'll only have to wait for the response, right? Similarly, the many actions, the many consequences that we are going through, what we refer to as fate, is some of the fate that we go through in this life is like the consequence of a sent mail. There's nothing much you can do about it. Maybe you can send another mail and clarify yourself or do some damage control. But a sent mail will have a certain response and you will have to deal with that response. But there are some consequences which probably are like that mail which is, you know, about to be sent, and you have the 3-second window. Even now you can correct your email and you can avert a tragedy, or you can avert being misunderstood. You can rephrase your email, right? Some of the consequences we face in life are like that. If we take right action, if we take the right steps now, we will be able to avert a certain bit of those consequences which are coming our way. And there are very, very few things which I said, you know, which have immediate consequences, which are like, you know, after you've typed it out, you have all the time to edit it and read through it 100 times and then send. And Swami says the best is the action which is about to be performed, right? The action which you are going to be performed is like what we are yet to type and which is still in our mind. So Swami says you think well, you reason well, you discriminate well before you do any action, right? Swami says that is the best. We'll come to that later. So, you know, it's very difficult to find out that the fate that we are going through, in which stage of that consequence it is in. If it is in the stage of the consequence of a sent email, we'll have to face it. You can either worsen the situation by sending further mails, or you can do a bit of damage control. So there is a fair bit of control in the actions that we perform now, in the choices that we make now. It's not completely under the control of our actions, but there is a very large amount of leverage that our actions and choices that we make can do, right? So whatever your fate is, you know, it becomes painful or otherwise, not because of the nature of the consequence itself. I think this is a very, very important point, you know, that we'll have to keep in mind. When I say that, you know, to a certain extent, the fate can be changed by efforts, what do I mean by say that it can only be done to an extent? But more importantly, the clue to that lies in what I said before, right? No, when I said that those actions which are backed by strong emotions become real karma, real deep karma, which we cannot escape, or it's like the consequences of the sent email, right? It becomes, at some point, we are answerable to them, right? But the clue which we can pick from there is, it all lies in the emotions, right? So whatever is the fate, whatever is the nature of our fate, it is as such not good or bad, but it is good or bad based on how we look at it, how we react to it, and how we accept it, right? So this is where Swami says that the two emotions of what Swami refers to as raga and dvesha, or attachment and hatred, or fondness towards something and sort of detesting some other results. And these are the two emotions, raga and dvesha, which literally decide whether what happens to us is good or bad. What happens by nature is not really good or bad, right? There are a lot of broad things of what we can say is, you know, you don't like to be cheated, you don't like to be harmed physically. There's some broad categorizations like that, but still what happens to us becomes good or bad only based on whether we are attached to that situation or we detest a certain consequence which can happen, right? It all depends on whether we are attached or whether we have a certain amount of hatred towards a particular consequence, right? We'll come to this later because this Raga Dvesha is a very, very important thing which Swami says even in another context which we'll refer to, right? So does the next question which arises is, this is about actions. Does doing spiritual practices change the fate? We all take to going for bhajans, we all take to doing Namaswarana and doing Seva and all of these things which Swami prescribes as spiritual practices, as sadhana. Does taking to spiritual practices change our fate, change our destiny? Well, the answer to that would be yes, it does, but not necessarily in the way that some people think. Because there are two things. One is karma, fate, or destiny. It's not a form of punishment and reward system, but it's a system of learning, right? You go through a certain experience to learn something. Sometimes when you go through a painful situation, you're supposed to learn compassion, you're supposed to learn forbearance. Or sometimes when you're going through a good situation, let's say when you're having a lot of wealth, you're going through that situation because you're supposed to learn to, you know, part with some of your wealth, to be able to share that wealth with others. So everything, good or bad, pleasant or unpleasant that happens to us, is not a form of reward or punishment, but is meant for a certain form of learning, right? So sometimes, through spiritual practices, we tend to learn faster. We tend to observe ourselves more. We tend to identify our flaws. And we end up learning faster through these spiritual practices. So when that happens, there is no necessity for us to go through that experience and learn sometimes, right? So sometimes through spiritual practices, when we learn faster, you know, Swami would change the course of life because there is no necessity for us to experience that particular difficulty or that particular experience. So that might happen. In that way, one thing is prayers and spiritual practices can change our fate. The second point is, spiritual practices, or what we call sadhana, is never for changing the fate. It is very wrong to approach spirituality or sadhana in that manner. And Swami would very, very often reiterate, all forms of spiritual practices are meant for the purification of the mind, or what we refer to as chitta shuddhi. So when that is the case, if we approach spiritual sadhana as a means of changing the course of our fate or destiny, I think we are using it for the wrong purpose, right? So as I said, it does change in some cases, but seeing that happen in somebody else's life, if we think that if I take to this spiritual practice, maybe even my life, the same disaster will be averted, I think we might be a little wrong, because it's a very subjective and case-to-case basis on which this will happen. We have to always approach spiritual practices as a means of purifying our mind, as a means of attaining that chitta shuddhi. And in this process through it helps. It's not like you will definitely suffer whatever you're supposed to suffer. You know, Swami would say that you don't go to a temple and pray to God that, you know, God save me from suffering. But you pray to God that, you know, God, I realize that whatever I'm going through is a consequence of my own actions. So I take responsibility for them. Please give me the strength to go through this and come out successful. So you don't go to God to avoid examinations, but you go to God praying that you do well in these examinations and you learn what is meant to be learned. So sadhana does help, but it helps by making us in many ways balanced and mature, right? By giving us the strength to deal with our problems and also to undergo with a certain amount of balance even our good karma, right? As I said, you know, if we are more fortunate than millions and millions of people in this world, we are living in much higher in the social strata. We have a roof over our head, we have good. So there is a certain amount of responsibility which comes even by the good that we get in life. So when we do spiritual sadhana, it not only gives us the strength to handle our difficult consequences of our past actions, but also the good consequences of our past actions. It gives us the balance to not get carried away by it, to keep us level-headed. And in that way, what doing spiritual sadhana does is, you know, you only suffer what has to be suffered, right? Because as I said, even as we are undergoing this karma, we are adding to that pile of sansita karma. So when we react to it and when we say that, no, I don't like this, or I want this deal to come through and I want to make this money and I want that, I don't want to fall ill. So when you have strong hatred and strong attachment towards anything, that only leads to more karma. So when we take to spiritual practices, it gives us a certain amount of balance and maturity by which we deal with these consequences in a much more mature manner, by which, you know, we only have to suffer as much as we need to suffer. We're not going to extend this by putting our raga and dvesha into it, right? Now I'll come to the point of astrology. You know, what is astrology and what are these other forms like palmistry and all these which we come across? To put it simply, it's a very, very precise science based on multiple calculations. Well, those of you who don't agree with me, please don't pounce on me. There's a raging debate whether you should call astrology a science or you should call it a belief system. But I think it is a very, very advanced and precise science. You know, it's based on the calculations that they do when a child is born. They know the specific time and they draw this birth chart and they see which, you know, where the different planets are at that particular moment. And based on that, they say that this is what will happen to the child, and, you know, he or she will grow up to, you know, be a good person or have a long life, and many of those things which are told. But is it a prediction or is it a calculation? You know, let me give you a simple example. You know, when we were in school, we used to always be given these simple problems where they would say that there are two stations, train stations, which are at a distance of so many kilometers, and let's say that there's some malfunction by which the tracks have kind of are intersecting, or they're, you know, in such a way that the two trains coming from both stations are going to collide. So they say that train A is traveling at such and such a speed and train B is traveling at such and such a speed. So at what point in that distance between the two stations will the two trains collide? And, you know, that's a mathematical problem. And we could calculate it based on the two speeds and the distances. It's a very simple mathematical calculation, right? Do we call that prediction? If I say that the two trains will collide in such and such a spot, would you call that prediction? It's not prediction, it's calculation. But even in that calculation, I am taking a lot of things to be granted, right? Like, what are the things? When I say that this will be the speed of the train, I'm considering that the weight that the two trains are carrying is exactly the same, so by which there's not going to be any difference. I'm assuming that the friction on the, you know, on the track is going to be the same, in so that there's not going to be any difference in the speed because of that. And I'm assuming a lot more other things, that nobody is going to pull the chain inside the train, and nobody is going to change the course of the train or whatever. I'm assuming a lot of things, and I'm saying that if all of these are constant and if these are the parameters that you give me, at this point, this will happen, right? A very same thing or very similar thing is done in astrology. They say that if these planets are in these places and if this is the calculation, then this is what will happen. It is not prediction, but it is a form of calculation. In just like in that example of the two trains colliding that I gave, even in astrology, it is only said that if all of these things are constant, if no external force is applied to this particular equation that you're giving me, let's say the child goes exactly the same, goes through the same childhood as suggested by this planet, or it undergoes this experience as suggested by that planet. So a lot of things are assumed and said that if everything goes on course, this is what will happen, right? Sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't happen. The same is the case with that example of the two trains. It's not that every time two trains keep colliding. There are many, many things that can happen in between the events of the train starting from the station and colliding. Similarly, there are many things that can happen from the time a child is born to that fate or destiny materializing. So in that sense, astrology is a form of calculating and literally like a mathematical solution to a problem. But what we have to keep in mind, especially when we are taking recourse in sciences like the astrology, is it's very, very, very complex. You know, you talk of the number of details they go into. It's phenomenal. In fact, there's one interesting fact which I heard from somebody once, that the way the Indian system, the Vedic system would calculate time used to be so very precise. We have actually lost that art now. You know, now only we can think of in hours, minutes and seconds. And the milliseconds are only a thing of matter for people probably running a 100-meter dash in the Olympics. But for most of us, it's only about, you know, hours and minutes. We don't even go to the second. We always schedule our meetings and, you know, we catch a train or we catch a bus based on the time, only going down to minutes, not even to seconds. And if at all anything, it's only up to the seconds. But if you see the Vedic way of seeing time, they would go into very, very minute units of time. Just to give you a small example of that, you know, a day, which is 24 hours, is broken down into what we call muhurtams, right? You always hear that word muhurtas. So 30 muhurtas, they say, make one day, where one muhurta is supposed to be about 48 minutes, right? And that one muhurta is made of two ghatis. That's the other form, which is about 24 minutes, right? And 60 vighatis make one ghati. And 60 liptas make one vighati. And one lipta, which is about half a second, is made of 60 likshakas. And each likshaka, they say, is made of 60 lavas. And one lava is made of 60 renus, and one renu is made of 60 thritis. So you can imagine how much is one thriti. So it is to that extent they would look at time. And now, if you look at it, how many of us have that precise a nature of noting time when, say, a child is born? And even if you have that, let's say that if you've managed to find the time to that last thriti, as it is said in the Vedas, then the person who is predicting the future of the child based on the horoscope has to be so good that he knows all of these calculations and he's able to do that perfect calculation. And more importantly, he's able to interpret that data to perfection. And the fact is, it's very, very difficult. And most people are very, very far from being accurate when it comes to reading horoscopes, right? And that's why Swami would say that you're ready to believe a wayside astrologer who tells you that you're having a bad time. You start feeling bad, you go into depression. But the whole science of astrology has come from the Vedas, and the Vedas declare that you are the Atman which can never be harmed or troubled by any force outside. But you don't believe that, right? I mean, that's really a paradox, isn't it? And Swami would say that any astrologer who comes and tells you, oh, this is going to happen to you, or this is what your chart says, we are ready to believe it. But the Vedas are here to take us to a state which is much, much more higher than that. So the whole idea is, yes, astrology is a science, astrology does work, but it is very difficult to completely go by what the astrologer says based on the horoscope, because one thing is, it's a form of calculation, considering that a lot of things are constant, and we assume a lot of things and then make a calculation, right? So it is that much, given to that much degree of errors. That is something we must remember. And the second thing is, of course, it's such a complex science that we don't have too many people who are very, very good at, you know, being so precise and being accurate in making predictions. And the third thing which I would like to say is, many times, you know, whatever is predicted in the astrology, whatever is predicted is going to happen to you in your future, what we need to do, what we have to act based on our station in life, if you're a student, if you're a householder, if you're a father, if you're a daughter, if you're a friend, if you're an employee, that actually does not change. Your astrology can tell you anything, but what we need to do, what actions we have to carry out, that never changes. You know, if someone tells a person that, you know, you're going to die at the age of 16, see, it does not mean that at the age of 15 and a half, that person gets an ailment. He does not take the efforts to cure himself of that ailment. Because Swami would say that this body is an instrument, the human birth is very precious. So the duty of that person is to try as much as possible to retain life in that body. That becomes the dharma of that person. Yes, eventually he may die at the age of 16. But what one has to do usually never changes based on what is expected in the future. So these are three things that you have to keep in mind. Now, coming back to the coming to that last bit of question in that second part, which was asked about, you know, can praying to Swami be better than praying to these planets, right? Well, one thing which Swami would often say, Swami would quote Tyagaraja, who used to sing these verses, where Tyagaraja would look at Rama and say, "Oh Rama, when your anugraha is there, what can the Navagrahas do to me?" Many, many times Swami would quote these in his discourses. And this is so true, that when you win the grace of the Lord, there is absolutely nothing. There is no hard and fast rule. There is nothing which can be, you know, which cannot be overcome. In fact, I hope I have the time to share one very, very beautiful story about one a former professor in a university. I think he's no more. His name is one Mr. Raghunath Safaya. And this person happens to come from a family which has this history of scholarship in astrology and palmistry. And they would pass this on from generation to generation. So they had this huge collection of books on astrology and palmistry. And he himself was an expert in that. And apart from having enormous knowledge in astrology and palmistry, he had enormous faith in astrology, right? You know, he would often say that, you know, they literally govern our lives and you can exactly tell what is going to happen to our life and all of these things. He would tell these to his students. He would in fact look in their palms and, you know, tell things about their personality and traits, which would be bang on, which would be absolutely precise, right? So here was this person, Raghunath Safaya. And so when you are having such strong faith in astrology, I think it is very difficult to have that sort of faith in Swami, right? And that was his problem, because he had immense faith in these predictive sciences. But when it came to Swami, he had a lot of love for Swami, he had a lot of reverence for Swami, but that was where his love and reverence stopped. He did not have complete faith in Swami. So apparently, one day, Swami had called him for an interview. And in the course of the interview, Swami was asking him about the students, about his teaching and all of that. And suddenly Swami asked him that, do you think that I can change the fate if a person surrenders to me? Right? This is the question Swami asked him. If a person surrenders to me, do you think Swami can change the fate? This person didn't say anything, because I think he did not believe that it is possible, because he believed that the Navagrahas are, you know, super powerful and they literally dictate what we do and choose in life. Then Swami held his hand and Swami asked him, "So have you read your own palm? Have you studied the palmistry of your own palm? And what does it say?" So of course he had, I mean, that must have been his first sample for his study. He must have read his hand a million times and he knew exactly where each line is. So he starts telling Swami that, "Swami, according to my palm, I should live for so many years and I should do this and all that." And Swami again asked him, "So you think that I cannot change what your palm tells about your life or what your palm suggests that your life should be?" And even as Swami was talking to him, Swami holds his hand and Swami gently rubs his hand. And when he looks down, he looks at his palm, and to his utter shock, he sees that his hand is completely blank. There is not a single line on his palm. The palm that he had seen for so many decades and he had read and reread and come to 100 million conclusions, he's looking at his palm and it is absolutely blank and plain. And he was shocked. And then Swami said that, "I know that you don't believe it is possible, but when somebody surrenders to me, I can change his life completely. I can change his or life so differently that no horoscope will suggest what will happen. No palmistry can predict what is going to happen." And literally Swami was proving it to him by wiping out his hand of all the lines, and with another stroke all the lines came back. And you can imagine the plight of this man who has lived all his life having his full faith in astrology and palmistry. He fell at Swami's feet and he literally cried and probably thanked his fortune at whose feet, you know, he had managed to reach. And he would share this to his students later, that after that interview, he did not go back to the university where he had to take class, but he went straight to his room. He pulled each and every book of astrology and palmistry which was there on the shelf. He bundled up in a bedsheet and he went to a well which was near the university. He dumped the whole thing and he said, good riddance, I don't need this anymore because I live with the Lord who can change every aspect of my day, destiny and fate. So can Swami change our destiny and fate? Of course he can. He absolutely can. There is no doubt about that. And that is why Swami would repeatedly say that when there is God's anugraha, there is no navagraha which can come in the way. But having said that, you know, when we pray to these planets, what are we trying to do? You know, we are doing it out of fear, right? We believe that this planet is going to harm me, this planet is going to trouble me. So let me, you know, appease the planet, let me do some puja, let me offer some oil, this particular flower and that particular colored cloth or something, whatever is the ritual related. The idea is we want to appease the planet so that the planet does not trouble us. But if we turn to Swami and if we start worshipping Swami for the same purpose, the Swami, I don't want to suffer in life. Swami, I don't want, you know, my children to suffer like this. I don't want to have failure in my business. If for the same reasons we turn to Swami and we start doing things which we believe Swami likes, like we do bhajans or we do seva and we do things which we think Swami likes, Swami will be happy and Swami will bless me like this, then I think along with the Navagrahas, we are making Swami one more planet. And Swami is definitely not going to be pleased by such worship. And that's why Swami would often say that what pleases me is surrender. I want you to surrender to me. And when you surrender to me, I will change anything. No fate or destiny can come between my grace and your life. So it is that surrender which will change, and it is when we pray to Swami, I mean, it's definitely much, much more than praying to any of these planets. But we cannot pray to Swami with the same motive with which we pray to these planets. When you pray to Swami, and Swami would say that what is that surrender that Swami talks about, right? If Swami says that I can change your fate commensurate to the surrender that you offer to me, what is that surrender? Swami has so many times told that when you turn to God and say, Swami, whatever you do is good for me. So you pray to Swami, you do whatever you need to do, like in the case of this problem with your son, you do whatever you think has to be done, and then you say to Swami, whatever happens is your will, I accept it wholeheartedly. And Swami would say, and this is where I make a reference again to those two qualities which Swami spoke about, the raga and dvesha. Because another beautiful point that Swami always makes when he speaks about the astrology is, Swami says, you are not troubled in your life by the Navagrahas, but you are troubled by two grahas alone. Only two grahas actually trouble you. And Swami says those two grahas are raga and dvesha. Swami says it is not Rahu and Ketu or Shani, it is raga and dvesha. Your attachment to something or your strong dislike to something. And the moment Swami says that you surrender to Swami, what happens is this attitude change happens. We start accepting whatever comes to us as Swami's prasadam. We say that Swami, whatever happens is good for me because you are giving it to me. And when that happens, automatically we are removing raga and dvesha from the equation. And when that happens, we are ready to face anything, right? So going back to those three forms of consequences, I said some consequences cannot be changed, they are fate that have to be accepted. There are some consequences which can be rerouted, it can be diverted, it can be avoided, but there are some consequences which can be completely removed without a trace. But it is very difficult for us to find out which part of the fate that we think is our life can be changed in this manner. But when we come to Swami and when we offer surrender, we probably will go through all of these three types of consequences. But when we surrender, the raga and dvesha is removed. So that consequence which is inevitable comes and goes without leaving a trace on us. We undergo that problem, but it does not trouble us. And those consequences which can be diverted, Swami will intervene and divert. And those which can be completely removed, Swami will do that. So we don't have to break our head about which is that fate for which we have to do a pariharam, which is that day fate for which, you know, we have to do charity, which is that fate which we have to completely sit down and accept without crying or, making a noise. So that is completely taken care of Swami. And in fact, that is again one thing we'll have to keep in mind, because there are different devotees for which Swami does different things. There are some devotees for whom Swami gives a handful of vibhuti and removes cancer. There are some devotees whom Swami allows them to undergo that cancer. We must remember that it is not that Swami is able to do and not able to do, or here Swami has power, Swami does not have powers. When we surrender to Swami, Swami chooses what needs to be undergone, what can be completely removed. And that is why taking recourse in Swami is definitely far, far, far better than taking recourse in any astrology or in any form of these predictive sciences. There's no doubt about that, right? So I think that hopefully that answers the question of, what happens when your horoscope says something and you turn to Swami. And in fact, I don't want to go into this. There are many, many, many examples I can give you. There are a few of my friends who started reading astrology out of their interest, right? You know, just as a science, they wanted to read it. And when they read it, they only found that, most of them had completely different, their lives were taking completely different courses compared to what their horoscope was telling. And in fact, some very good astrologers would often say this, that when a person is leading a very good life, a very dharmic life, or a very spiritual life, the same planets which we talk as bad planets, like Shani or Rahu or Ketu, they start becoming beneficial planets because it will help them in their spiritual progress. These are, in that sense called spiritual planets. So what we refer to as good time, bad time, all of that is subject to our maturity, which changes with our spiritual practice. And when it turns to devotion and surrender, there is no limit as to how much it can be transformed and how much it can be wiped out completely. So without worrying about that, of course, we need to focus on our surrender. But before I conclude, of course, the most important part that was asked was about the son who is undergoing this thing. Let's say that somebody in our family is having this problem and, we do this thing of reading that person's horoscope. At best, this knowledge that so-and-so is suffering because of some planetary reasons should not stop us from taking action, as I explained. It should not stop us from doing what is necessary. But at best, it can give us a little bit of sympathy and, understanding for that person's problems. Like in the case of your son whom you have mentioned, yes, it should give you a little bit of understanding and it should give you more patience in dealing with him, because you know that he is probably under the influence of something which is beyond him, right? So you are doing the right thing by praying for him and by hoping that Swami changes his mind, but that should also give you a little more understanding. Coming to the point of, him having bad company, and I'm sure that a person who regularly goes to Samiti, sings bhajans there, has as much bad company as good company, so I don't think it can be completely attributed to that. But as I know where this question is coming from, the person is anonymous, but I know it's coming from a Western country. In cultures like this, and in fact in the modern day, even in India, it doesn't help if parents want to be obeyed. And if you feel that I'm telling my son and he's not ready to accept my advice, and he doesn't listen to his parents, I think it is not possible in these days. You have to try and become more friendly to your son and try to speak him out of the problem, try to find out what is the real issue. Don't come to the conclusion that, the astrologer said that it's going to be 3 years of bad period, so there's no point talking to him, there's no point, trying to find out what is the real issue. Let that knowledge of horoscope only give you a little more patience and empathy towards the problem he's undergoing, but become more friendly and try to speak the problem out of him. And you said you believe that it could be an influence of bad company. All that you can do is replace that company by you yourself becoming a friend to your son. And, I think pretty much whatever you have to do, you're already doing. But if you really wish to help your son, I think this is what you'll have to do. Don't expect him to obey you, but try to become more friendly and try to elicit what really is the problem. And probably there you will get a better solution as to how to deal with this problem. But I hope the main answer that you sought, the last question that you ended your question with, can God's grace change the fate at any cost? Yes, of course it can, but in many ways there is that catch. You cannot seek God's grace to change your fate. You seek God's grace only out of love, only out of your surrender and devotion. When that happens, God's grace can change everything. There's no doubt about that. But we see God's grace working in someone else's life who's approaching Swami in that love and devotion and surrender, and we believe that it doesn't happen to us. It only means that our approach is wrong. It's not that Swami does for somebody and does not do for me. It's only that my approach is wrong, or it's not necessary for me. It is necessary for me to go through that particular time I need to go through. I need to suffer what I have to suffer. It can only mean that. It does not mean that God's grace cannot overrule our fate or destiny. I hope I managed to answer whatever you had asked. If you have any more clarifications to ask, feel free to write to me. Thank you for writing this question. As I said, I'm sure that there are many other listeners who had similar doubts, especially about astrology and about our fate and what God's grace can do. So thank you for that question. With that, dear listeners, it's time to wrap up this week's program. Thank the questioner for sending that beautiful question. If you have a question on how to apply Swami's message in our daily life, and we'll be very glad to feature it on this program, all you have to do is send in a mail to me, to my personal mail ID. That's prem@radiosai.org. That's prem@radiosai.org. And if you could record the question in your own voice, I think that would be more than perfect. It would be wonderful to play the question in your own voice. If you wish to be anonymous, do let me know. I will not mention your name. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. I thank Swami for this opportunity to dwell into this message. I thank each one of you for your patient listening. I'm going to leave you with a classic Telugu song, a song which we have sung many, many times in front of Swami. Swami would also enjoy this song. I hope you enjoy it. On the other side of the song, you'll have the program on the Ashtotram hosted by Raghu. At around 12:30, or maybe a little later than 12:30, me and Arvind will join you for this week's afternoon satsang. Thank you. Do join me again next week at 11 a.m. for the next episode of Radio Sai, Answering Both.
ಶರಣಮನಿ ಸನ್ನು ತಿಂತು ವೇಳ ನಿನ್ನು ಗನಿ ಶರಣಮನಿ ಸನ್ನು ತಿಂತು ವೇಳ ಜನ್ಮ ಸಂಯಮವು ತೊಂದಿ ಬಾಬಾ
ಜನ್ಮ ಸಂಯಮವು ತೊಂದಿ ಬಾಬಾ
ಧಾತವನಿ ಕಲಚುಕೊನಿ ಜೋತಲಿಡೆ ವೇಳ ಹೃದಯ ಮುಪ್ಪೊಂಗು ತೊಂದಿ ಬಾಬಾ
ಹೃದಯ ಮುಪ್ಪೊಂಗು ತೊಂದಿ ಬಾಬಾ
ಆ ah.
రాముడైన రహీమైన నానకైన క్రీస్తైన పరమాత్ముని ప్రతినిధులన్నావు. మతం పేర కులం పేర మత్సరాలు తగదంటూ మానవతకు జ్యోతులెత్తినావు.
రాముడైన రహీమైన నానకైన క్రీస్తైన పరమాత్ముని ప్రతినిధులన్నావు. మతం పేర కులం పేర మత్సరాలు తగదంటూ మానవతకు జ్యోతులెత్తినావు.
కటిక విషం నింది మాకు కరుణ పంచినావు. అపరంజి వెలుగు
అపరంజి వెలుగు అపరంజి వెలుగు నీవు.
ను నివారించి బాధలను నిరోధించి ఆర్తులకు పేద తీర్చినావు. శరణాగతులందరికీ జగ్గతులను కలిగించి సమతామూర్తివై నిలిచినావు.
జాధులను నివారించి బాధలను నిరోధించి ఆర్తులకు పేద తీర్చినావు. శరణాగతులందరికీ జగ్గతులను కలిగించి సమతామూర్తివై నిలిచినావు.
సహన తరువు పండించిన శాంతి ఫలము నీవు. గురువులకే సద్గురువైనావు
గురువులకే
సద్గురువైనాకే
సద్గురువైనావు.
నిన్ను గని శరణమ్మని తన్ను తింటు వేళ నిన్ను గని శరణమ్మని సన్ను తింటు వేళ నన్న ధన్యమవుతుంది బాబా.